Hello and welcome to our program, Memory Lane, brought to you by Owl Radio and the Low Vision Resource Center. I'm Eric Chase, and during the next half hour, I'll be reading articles from Reminisce Magazine here on Owl Radio. Backyard Hangout. Bill Rogerson, Lake Wales, Florida. Some of my best memories are of my own backyard at 85 Orange Street in Waltham, Massachusetts in the 1950s. It felt like a great expanse that seemed to go on as far as the eye could see. It was the center of activity for the entire neighborhood. We spent long hours playing army, building push carts, and having shooting competitions with my Daisy Red Ryder BB gun. And no, I didn't shoot my eye out. There was a grassy area where we played outdoor games or set up the pup tent. We would collect grasshoppers from the garden and put them in a pickle jar. Bragging rights went to the kid with the largest catch. In the winter, we built forts and had snowball fights. I wouldn't trade those days for all the tea in China. American Barman made Mondays sweet. Kids kept one ear cocked for the sound of the ice cream truck coming down the street. Josephine Mealy, Moraga, California. Every Monday around 3 p.m., some sharp-eared kid would hear bells on the next block and yell, "American Bar is coming!" Kids scrambled in every direction to get a dime as Gus, the ice cream man, drove his sparkling white truck onto Clarendon Drive on Long Island, New York. My dad, Tony, loved ice cream, and Monday was his day off. He'd buy ice cream for any kid who didn't have money. Gus knew a good thing when he saw it and parked his truck right in front of our house. It was the 50s, and Gus, a Greek immigrant, owned his own American Bar truck. Painted on the side of the truck were colorful photos of ice cream sandwiches, bars, sundaes, and pops, so that little kids who couldn't read could just point. My mom, Lee, approved of Gus's neatly ironed white pants and starched shirt, black bow tie and white captain's hat with a black brim. His highly polished black shoes didn't escape her notice either. Gus knew everyone's favorite ice cream. He'd try to get me to order something else, but I stuck with vanilla. And my sister, Fran, always got a sundae cup. My brother, Joe, got whatever was new and colorful. When I started dating, I was surprised that Gus knew my boyfriend's name.
"Joey, what are you doing on this street?" he asked.
Years later, our son, another Joe, got to meet the American Barman. Gus handed him a vanilla pop.
"Your mama's favorite."
Joe was impressed. For his fifth birthday, he asked for a change maker so he could be just like Gus. Labor of Love. Elaine Heath, Omaha, Nebraska. My mother allowed some of her 13 children to walk in a parade on Labor Day in 1954. A farm family of Czechoslovakian descent, we felt honored to be part of the parade in Schuyler, Nebraska. My dad and two of my brothers made the cart, which we knew would be very useful on our farm. We added goldenrods on the tires, signifying our love for the Nebraska flower. Mom sewed ruffles onto the bottoms of our skirts and used peach basket covers to create the best hats in the parade. She let my brothers wear their Sunday best, and she hand-lettered the sign for the front of the cart. "Children, our most important crop." We were so curious to see how the city folk organized and directed the local parade. The sight of the floats, bands, fire engines, and horses was an unusual one for us hard-working farm kids. Our cart won first place in the kiddies division, and with the $10 prize, we went to the Dairy Queen for ice cream cones. Cold Calls. Family Business Kept Customers on Ice. By David Mimoser, Hamburg, New York. My father, Richard Mimoser, was the local iceman in Hamburg from the late 1940s through the 1960s. The ice business was a family affair for our mom, Laura, and us five kids. Dad worked with several employees, his lifelong friends. When I was 8 or 9, I went with Dad on his regular deliveries. Customers placed an ice card in their windows indicating how much they wanted. They could order 25, 50, or 75 pounds of ice. Dad stopped the truck at each house and placed their order in an oak ice box, then collected payment. Dad delivered to local taverns where, on a hot day, he'd order a draft beer and I'd get an orange soda. They were a dime apiece. He also filled ice machines, and every Sunday around the kitchen table, the whole family counted quarters from the vending machines. We checked the date of each coin to see if it should be added to Dad's coin collection. If the fire horn sounded during deliveries, the ice business came to a halt. Dad was also a volunteer fireman in Hamburg. Sometimes my mom had to fill in for Dad and drive the ice truck for the day. In summer, there were additional deliveries. Every year, Dad supplied the concession ice for the Buffalo Raceway and the Erie County Fair, where the live fish tanks at the conservation building needed to be kept cool. Dad's base of operation was the ice house at Prospect and Hawkins Avenues, where the ice was made. Tools of the trade were ice picks, holsters, shoulder pads, and ice tongs. The temperature inside the ice house was between 15 and 20 degrees, and even on the hottest days, we wore heavy jackets, red wool shirts, and gloves. In later years, the ice was made elsewhere, and the building was used to store the ice before delivery. The building is now used by the Hamburg Recreation Department, and my great-grandchildren attend summer programs there. In one way or another, the building has been a part of our family for 5 generations. Silence makes the heart grow fonder. He didn't pay much attention at first. Terry Hamblin, Mount Juliet, Tennessee. Emma Petty was a quiet girl, and she usually had a book in her hand. She was also pretty. But to be honest, when I went to her house one Saturday afternoon in the summer of 1954, I wasn't expecting to ask her on a date. I wanted to go to a baseball game with her brother, Paul. He wasn't home, so I asked Emma to go with me instead. I found out later through her sisters that she didn't intend to go out with me either. When she disappeared in the house, supposedly to ask her mother's permission, she was looking for an excuse to politely decline. But her mother and sisters convinced her to go out with me and have fun. Our car ride into town was a quiet one. We were both happy not to have to fill the ride with chatter. We didn't mind just sitting together. That was our first date. There wasn't much to do in Mount Juliet, but soon we spent time together however we could. We attended church and more ball games together, and we loved going to the malt shop. We rarely went to the movies. My job paid only 50 cents a day, and the movies cost a quarter. I quickly came to realize that this quiet woman who always had a cross stitch or a new book in her hand was the one I wanted to marry. One day, I sneaked her class ring on my finger so I could figure out the right size for an engagement ring. Before I left for Air Force boot camp, I asked her to marry me. She said, "I have to finish school first." So we waited until she finished school. And then we waited a bit longer, because the Air Force trained me on a plane they decided to retire just as I was finishing up schooling on it. Our Thanksgiving wedding was pushed back, but on December 23, 1955, we married. Harrowing spot on warship. First-hand look at sailor's life below decks. By Steve Carl, Raymond, Maine. My father, Edward Carl, served in the Navy from 1942 to 1946 and was a crew member on the USS Massachusetts deployed to the Pacific. He was on the crew for a 16-inch gun, the largest weapon on the ship. Since Edward was only 17, his father, Charles, had to sign the papers that allowed him to enlist, much to the distress of his mother, Ethel. Edward was very skinny and could easily fit through the small hatches, so he was stationed way down on the lower deck where the powder and shells were loaded and sent up to the gun on the top deck via elevators. Being on one of the lower decks meant that he had little chance of survival if the ship was hit. Dad met my mom, Anne, at Old Orchard Beach, Maine, when he and a Navy buddy were on leave. My parents married in 1945 while Dad was still in the Navy. When my dad returned from the service, he tried his hand at a few things and eventually learned steel rule die making. He was one of the few people still practicing the craft in the 60s and 70s. One of his last jobs was assembling CNC milling machines at a company in Hopkinton, Massachusetts. He helped me get a job there, which launched my career as an engineer. Dad always spoke proudly of his time in the service. In 1965, our family was present when the Massachusetts was brought out of mothballs to be restored as a memorial and a museum. I was 9 and remember being so proud. My wife and I have taken our children and grandchildren to see the ship docked in Battleship Cove in Fall River, Massachusetts. Recently, I watched a Navy training film that must have been like what Dad saw when he was trained. I imagined him as a teenager, sitting with other recruits, learning about his assigned role on the ship. Throughout his life, my dad kept in touch with a former crewmate, Jack Becker. They got together every year or so until my dad died in 1996. Irish Union Soldier. Escaping the famine in his homeland, he fought for the North. By Maureen King Cassidy, Oyster Bay, New York. The potato crops in Ireland had several years of failures in the mid-1800s, and in 1845, the Great Famine began to ravage the country. Individuals and entire families left the country by the hundreds of thousands. Many Irish coming to the U.S. were greeted with the notice, "No Irish need apply." One of those immigrants was my ancestor, James Deary, who landed in Brooklyn, New York. James, my great-great-great uncle, was born in Donegal, Ireland in 1841. He left for the U.S. via Liverpool when he was 9. Like many poor immigrants, he stayed in the place where he landed. When the Civil War broke out, James enlisted for the Union, joining the 6th Cavalry Regiment, regular army, as a private. He was at Gettysburg with his unit on July 3, 1863, the last day of the conflict. James was injured that day and received a monthly pension for the rest of his life. In 1913, he returned to Gettysburg for a reunion of the Union and Confederate soldiers. After the war, he worked for many years for the New York City Fire Department. Over 150 years later, I'm proud that my Irish ancestor participated in the Battle of Gettysburg, which remains one of the bloodiest and most famous battles in U.S. history. The following article is a response to the previous one. Join the Cavalry by Peggy Clemens Lauritsen, an accredited genealogist. Having escaped hardship in their native countries, many immigrants volunteered for military service in America. Hundreds of thousands, especially German and Irish, enlisted in the Union armies. James Deary arrived on the ship Princeton of New York with an older man of the same name. What were his thoughts when he came ashore? We know he brought a heritage of love and loyalty and was one of those willing to sacrifice for his adopted country. The National Park Service website confirms Deary was part of the 6th Regiment, U.S. Cavalry, Regular Army. The regiment's motto? Led by love of country. At the start of the war, the cavalry was limited to patrolling, scouting, guarding supplies, and escorting officers. However, by 1863, the men were serving as fighters. The 6th Regiment suffered heavy casualties during its time at Gettysburg and Fairfield, Pennsylvania. Steer takes the lead at the farm show. His owner learns to pick himself up after a fall. By Donald Moyer, Boyertown, Pennsylvania. Every day for months, I fed, brushed, and combed Scotty, a Black Angus steer. Scotty was my 4-H club project in 1947. And it's hard to describe the close ties that we formed through the daily routine on our farm in Landis Store, Pennsylvania. At the end of that summer, Scotty and I entered the Reading Fair in Berks County, Pennsylvania. We won third place, and so we were invited to the District Livestock Show in Lancaster. Again, we placed near the top of the show, which entitled us to participate in the big one, the Pennsylvania Farm Show, in January 1948. The show is still held today in the state capital, Harrisburg. Everything went smoothly as we arrived at the farm show. Scotty and I prepared for the parade in the arena. He was all washed and brushed, and I was dressed in 4-H show garb, which consisted of a white shirt and white pants. As a 14-year-old, I was mindful of the many young ladies who were all around. I wrapped Scotty's halter strap around my arm, and we lined up to walk into the arena. Suddenly, Scotty took off, pulling me off my feet and dragging me. Talk about embarrassment. This rates as number one. My red face was a contrast with the white uniform covered in black and brown from the arena. That day ended with the auctioning of the animals. One of the top meat companies in the U.S. at that time bought Scotty. Though the tears flowed freely on that day over 70 years ago, I believe my experience in 4-H helped me build a strong base, which led to my many successful years as an elementary school principal. A Quick Wrap-Up by Robert Abel, Linthicum Heights, Maryland. My friend Steve Rogalski and I grew up together in Beelsville, Ohio in the 60s. We were in 4-H, and in 1966, we chose as our project a demonstration of basic first aid bandages. Somehow, that work at the county level qualified us for a trip to the Ohio State Fair. Going to the big city to present to a large audience was intimidating. When it was our turn on stage, we were given microphones to use, which had not been part of our practice routine. As I demonstrated how to properly apply a sling to my victim, Steve, the microphone cord became tangled and got caught in the bandage. In one quick move, Steve had been slinged and wired. I was embarrassed and didn't know what to do, so I kept going. Looking back, I realized that was just another valuable life lesson I learned from 4-H. When things don't go as planned, find a way around it and keep going. Steve and I live far apart now, but one of the countless memories we still laugh about is our miscue at the Great Ohio State Fair. Rodeo contests were a barrel of fun. Horse and rider set a fast pace. Pamela Foster, Lisbon, Ohio. Clarkson, Ohio, where I grew up in the 70s, was the epitome of small-town USA. There was one crossroad, one streetlight on the cement pad where every kid hung out, and everyone knew everything about everybody. My grandfather bought my first pony for my 5th birthday. I remember the ride home like it was yesterday, sitting tall and proud like I owned the world, on Apache, a beautiful, full-blooded, Hackney pony. I was in 6th grade when I discovered 4-H. It was heaven for an awkward kid with few friends to find people who were as horse-crazy as I. For several years, I showed Apache, competing in shows every weekend. But the main event was the yearly Columbiana County Fair in Lisbon. Kids from all over converged on a dirty, dusty plot of land laced with gifts from the livestock, straw, mud, and the best and greasiest fair food ever. There were friends to be made, competitions to enter, and baths were non-existent. Apache loved the halter confirmation competitions, which was basically me leading him around the ring and showing off how gorgeous he was. I, however, also wanted to go fast and barrel race, so the last year I competed, I rode my dad's horse, Chandel. She was a senior quarter horse, but she had no idea older ladies were supposed to be reserved, quiet, and slow. She loved the speed competitions too, and even though we never won a ribbon, we had a blast. I competed in one class in which riders showcased how well their horses followed leg and bridle cues. I had the great idea to let Chandel show how quick she was and how tightly she could turn. The next day, an announcement was made that, going forward, a rider would be disqualified for stunts like Chandel and I had pulled. I wonder if that's still a rule. That was also the year I learned boys were treated differently than girls. It was an unwritten rule that kids could stay in the barns with their horses, so I was looking forward to it. But shortly before the fair started, the board decided that only boys were allowed to stay in the barns with their animals. I was outraged. With the full support of my parents, I chopped my long hair off and wore hoodies to disguise my appearance so I could room with my buddy. It was a successful ruse, and 4-H taught me, however inadvertently, to stand up for things I believe in. I'm so thankful for the time I spent in 4-H. It taught me that not everyone who competes for a trophy will get one, and that shouldn't be the goal anyway. The goal should be to have fun, make friends, and learn about yourself, which I did and continue to do to this day. Itchy to Itsy Bitsy. Evolution of the Swimsuit Over the Century by Mary Liz Shaw. Few areas of fashion have altered as much over the past 100 years as swimwear. Each decade saw the shedding of more cloth or new fabric innovations to match shifting attitudes towards water sports and sun worship. In the early 1900s, women's beachwear outfits have skirts or shorts that come to the knee, matching hats, and socks or stockings. Most are all wool, which makes them a nuisance, even a hazard, when soaking wet. A key player in rescuing women from the weight of voluminous bathing dresses is Annette Kellerman, a pro swimmer from Australia, arrested in Boston in 1907 for wearing a man's one-piece swimsuit. She raises awareness of swimming for fitness, and as more women show interest in the sport, they seek suits closer to those men wear, form-fitting, with sleeveless, tank-style tops. By the middle of the 1920s, some brave women don one-piece suits with thigh-cut legs. In the early 30s, Lastex, yarn-covered rubber, makes swimsuits tighter, lighter, and easier to swim in. Plain romper one-piece suits for women give way to innovative styling that might include cutouts or cross straps. Men and boys wear high-waisted trunks. A few men go shirtless. The early 1940s sees the dominance of spaghetti straps and sweetheart necklines. The one-piece rules for women. A few are strapless, others might have ruching or an A-line skirt that mimics dress styles. Suits are still made of Lastex, but jersey, rayon, and cotton are in too, especially for men and children. The daring new look is the two-piece that shows a woman's midriff, although her belly button remains safely hidden. Interest in the style is aided by wartime rationing to avoid using excess fabric. The revolution against modesty continues in 1946, when the French designer Louis Rayard introduces the bikini. Rubber bathing caps with fabric flourishes protect women's complicated hairdos, but Hollywood swimming star Esther Williams strikes a blow for bare heads in the early 1950s. Acetate and taffeta join the swimsuit fabric arsenal in the 1950s for styles that look polished and feminine. Strapless suits have boning and other hardware to keep everything neat and shapely, but vigorous exercise is out. Lounging is in. In France, Brigitte Bardot wears a bikini to the Cannes Film Festival in 1953. In the 1960s, girl next door Annette Funicello makes the bikini mainstream in her beach movies. Bright florals and graphics are designed to attract the eye. Meanwhile, Speedo in Australia makes thin suits that won't drag. American Mark Spitz wins 7 gold medals at the 1972 Olympics in his Speedo, and soon, men everywhere are wearing the brand. The 1970s sees Farrah Fawcett in a low-cut one-piece. And in the 80s, legs finally get a moment in the sun with ultra-high cuts. Lately, singer Taylor Swift has led a trend back to the styles of the 1950s, while men sport the long, loose shorts favored by surfers. Treasured pen marks history. At the Capitol, a crack young speller meets a famous fellow Texan. By David Nelson, Houston, Texas. When I was 14 in 1959, I traveled to Washington, D.C. to compete in the Scripps National Spelling Bee. As the regional winner from Lubbock, Texas, I was invited to meet then-Senator Lyndon B. Johnson, Texas Democrat, who was Senate Majority Leader at the time. He shook my hand and presented me with a pen that featured a miniature picture of Johnson inside the capsule and the inscription, "Compliments of Lyndon B. Johnson, your United States Senator." I've often wondered if today's National Spelling Bee competitors get the kind of VIP treatment I enjoyed then. I met both Texas senators and had lunch with Lubbock's Congressman George Mahan. I toured the White House, Bureau of Engraving, Andrews Air Force Base, and FBI headquarters, and took a trip down the Potomac River to Mount Vernon. The Spelling Bee was held at the historic Mayflower Hotel. I've gone back many times over the years, reliving the excitement of that first memorable visit. Though I didn't win, I placed 12th out of 70 spellers. I remember the tournament and all the events fondly. Most of all, more than 60 years later, I still treasure that pen from LBJ. I've never seen another one like it. It's a special memento of a wonderful time in my life from a man who later became the President of the United States. You've been listening to Memory Lane on Owl Radio. You can listen to Owl Radio on our specially tuned radio or by streaming on your computer or smartphone. You may also listen at your convenience on our podcast page at www.owlradio.org. Thank you for listening. This program will be replayed after 9 p.m. this evening. This is Eric Chase saying goodbye from Owl Radio.